with a little help from my friends. I was lucky to have come to America years before the political upheaval in Iran. The Americans we encountered were kind and curious, unafraid to ask questions and willing to listen. As soon as I spoke enough English to communicate, I found myself being interviewed nonstop by children and adults alike. My life became one long-running Oprah show, minus the free luxury accommodations in Chicago and Oprah. On the topic of Iran, American minds were tabulae rasae. Judging from the questions asked, it was clear that most Americans in 1972 had never heard of Iran. We did our best to educate. You know Asia? Well, you go south at the Soviet Union and there we are. Or we try to be more bucolic, mentioning being south of the beautiful Caspian Sea where the famous caviar comes from. Most people in Whittier did not know about the famous caviar, and once we explained what it was, they'd scrunch up their faces. Fish eggs, they would say. Gross! We tried mentioning our proximity to Afghanistan or Iraq, but it was no use. Having exhausted our geographical clues, we would say, "You've heard of India, Japan, or China. We're on the same continent." We had always known that ours is a small country and that America is very big. But even as a 7-year-old, I was surprised that so many Americans had never noticed us on the map. Perhaps it's like driving a Yugo and realizing that the 18-wheeler can't see you. In Iran, geography is a requirement in every grade. Since the government issues textbooks, every student studies the same material in the same grade. In first grade geography, I had to learn the shape of Iran and the location of its capital, Tehran. I had to memorize that we shared borders with Turkey, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and the USSR. I also knew that I lived on the continent of Asia. None of the kids in Whittier, a city an hour outside of Los Angeles, ever asked me about geography. They wanted to know about more important things, such as camels. How many did we own back home? What did we feed them? Was it a bumpy ride? I always disappointed them by admitting that I had never seen a camel in my entire life. And as far as a ride goes, our Chevrolet was rather smooth. They reacted as if I had told them that there really was a person in the Mickey Mouse costume. We were also asked about electricity, tents, and the Sahara. Once again, we disappointed, admitting that we had electricity, that we did not own a tent, and that the Sahara was on another continent. Intent to remedy the image of our homeland as backward, my father took it upon himself to enlighten Americans whenever possible. Any unsuspecting American who asked my father a question received, as a bonus, a lecture on the successful history of the petroleum industry in Iran. As my father droned on, I watched the faces of these kind Americans who were undoubtedly making mental notes never to talk to a foreigner again. My family and I wondered why Americans had such a mistaken image of Iran. We were offered a clue one day by a neighbor who told us that he knew about Iran because he had seen Lawrence of Arabia. Whoever Lawrence was, we had never heard of him, we said. My father then explained that Iranians are an Indo-European people. We are not Arabs. We do, however, have two things in common with Saudi Arabia, he continued, Islam and petroleum. Now, I won't bore you with religion, he said, but let me tell you about the petroleum industry. Another neighbor, a kindly old lady who taught me how to take care of indoor plants, asked me whether we had many cats back home. My father, with his uncanny ability to forge friendship, said, "We don't keep pets in our homes. They are dirty." "But your cats are so beautiful," our neighbor said. We had no idea what she was talking about. Seeing our puzzled expressions, she showed us a picture of a beautiful, long-haired cat. "It's a Persian cat," she said. That was news to us. The only cats we had ever seen back home were the mangy strays that ate scraps behind people's houses. From that day, when I told people I was from Iran, I added, "Where Persian cats come from?" That impressed them. I tried my best to be a worthy representative of my homeland, but like a Hollywood celebrity relentlessly pursued by paparazzi, I sometimes got tired of the questions. I, however, never punched anyone with my fists. I use words. One boy at school had a habit of asking me particularly stupid questions. One day, he inquired about camels again. This time, perhaps foreshadowing a vocation in storytelling, I told him that yes, we had camels, a one hump and a two hump. The one hump belonged to my parents, and the two hump was our family station wagon. His eyes widened. "Where do you keep them?" he asked. "In the garage, of course," I told him. Having heard what he wanted to hear, he ran off to share his knowledge with the rest of the kids on the playground. He was very angry once he realized that I had fooled him, but at least he never asked me another question. Often kids tried to be funny by chanting, "I ran to Iran, I ran to Iran." The correct pronunciation, I always inform them, is Iran. "I ran" is a sentence, I told them, as in, "I ran away from my geography lesson." Older boys often ask me to teach them some bad words in your language. At first, I politely refused. My refusal merely increased their determination. So I solved the problem by teaching them phrases like "man kharam," which means "I'm an idiot." I told them that what I was teaching them was so nasty that they would have to promise never to repeat it to anyone. They would then spend all of recess running around yelling, "Man kharam, man kharam, I'm an idiot, I'm an idiot." I never told them the truth. I figured that someday somebody would. But almost every person who asked us a question asked with kindness. Questions were often followed by suggestions of places to visit in California. At school, the same children who inquired about camels also shared their food with me. "I bet you've never tried an Oreo. Have one." Or, "My mom just baked these peanut butter cookies and she sent you one." Kids invited me to their houses to show me what their rooms looked like. On Halloween, one family brought over a costume, knowing that I would surely be the only kid in the Halloween parade without one. If someone had been able to encapsulate the kindness of these second graders in pill form, the pills would undoubtedly put many war correspondents out of business. After almost 2 years in Whittier, my father's assignment was completed and we had to return home. The last month of our stay, I attended one slumber party after another, all thrown in my honor. This avalanche of kindness did not make our impending departure any easier. Everyone wanted to know when we would come back to America. We had no answer, but we invited them all to visit us in Iran. I knew no one would ever take us up on our offer because Iran was off the radar screen for most people. My friends considered visiting their grandmothers in Oregon to be a long trip. So visiting me in Iran was like taking a left turn at the next moon. It wasn't going to happen. I didn't know then that I would indeed be returning to America about 2 years later. Between frenzied shopping trips to Sears to buy presents for our relatives back home, my mother spent her last few weeks giving gifts to our American friends. I had wondered why my mother had brought so many Persian handicrafts with her. Now I knew. Everyone from my teachers to the crossing guard to the brownie leader to the neighbors received something. "This is from my country, especially for you," she would explain. These handicrafts, which probably turned up in garage sales the following year, were received with tears and promises to write. My mother was particularly sad to return to Iran. I had always assumed that she would be relieved to return to her family and to a land where she spoke the language and didn't need me to act as an interpreter. But I realized later that even though my mother could not understand anything the crossing guard, Mrs. Popkin, said, she understood that this woman looked out for me. And she understood her smiles. Even though my mother never attended a brownie meeting, she knew that the leader, Carrie's mom, opened up her home to us every week and led us through all kinds of projects. No one paid her for this. And my mother knew that when it had been my turn to bring snacks for the class, one of the moms had stepped in and baked cupcakes. My best friend Connie's older sister, Michelle, had tried to teach me to ride a bike, and Heather's mom, although single with two daughters, had hosted me overnight more times than I could remember. Even though I had been the beneficiary of all the attention, my mother, watching silently from a distance, had also felt the warmth of generosity and kindness. It was hard to leave. When my parents and I get together today, we often talk about our first year in America. Even though 30 years have passed, our memories have not faded. We remember the kindness more than ever, knowing that our relatives who immigrated to this country after the Iranian Revolution did not encounter the same America. They saw Americans with bumper stickers on their cars that read, "Iranians, go home," or "We play cowboys and Iranians." The Americans they met rarely invited them to their houses. These Americans felt that they knew all about Iran and its people, and they had no questions, just opinions. My relatives did not think Americans were very kind.